The following recording may contain explicit language. I can't get more explicit than may. Let's just say it may. It's Friday, September 13th, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. There was no clear winner in last night's debate, but punching himself in the face was Julian Castro, who went hard at Biden. But as Joe Biden's dad used to tell him back in Scranton, Joe, when you come for the king, what? There's a king? Where? King! Here, boy! Here, boy! Now, I gotta say, Castro came off a little like, well, do we play the explicit warning? There's a word that's on the line of explicit. You could say it on network television, but I still think it's apt, though harsh. Came off like a dick. Kind of a dick. So there was one clear loser. There was no clear winner. Though it wasn't for a lack of trying in the attempt to be clear.
So let's be clear about health.
Let us be clear, Joe.
And we just need to be clear about what. Let's be clear. Let's be clear about this.
Let me be very clear.
Let me be very clear.
Let me be clear. I am.
Let's just be clear.
And let's be clear in all the ways.
I happen to believe also that what to me democratic socialism means is we deal with an issue. We do not discuss enough, Jorge.
Oh, sorry. That last one wasn't Senator Sanders talking about needing to be clear. It was an instance of him needing some throat clearing. Have you noticed that no one ever prefaces a truly clear statement with the words, let me be clear? Clarity is its own quality. It's like humility or virtue. You can't convey it by calling someone else's attention to your own. When you hear, let me be clear, the speaker is basically admitting, you might not like this, or I'm going to get a little defensive, but... Speaking of defensive, there wasn't one question about the subject of defense. Not in general. They talked about the war in Afghanistan, but what about the defense budget, for instance? So I elicited such a question. In fact, I elicited a few could-have-been questions from a panel of experts. Because you always see and hear, at least I do on Twitter, the refrain, you know, this whole debate, and there wasn't even a question on. There weren't any questions about Yemen. There weren't any questions about clean water. There weren't any questions about Cory Booker's diet. Actually, there was a question about Cory Booker's diet. So, okay, panel of smart people who I hit up. If you were the moderator, what question would you have asked? So, here are the responses I got. Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine, who's at the debate, says, what's your number one attribute for a Supreme Court justice? Which one is your all-time favorite? Do you think there should always be 9 justices? All right, in order here, what my answers. What's the number one attribute? That he already owns a robe. Who's your all-time favorite? Learned hand. Do you think there should be 9 justices? No, it would be better if Clarence Thomas sat a few out. Okay. From now on, I'll just give you the questions that should have been asked, not my retorts, and I will also acknowledge, I know, learned hand never made it to the top court. Grace Seegers of CBS News would have liked, what actions would your administration take if Roe v. Wade was overturned? There were, in fact, no abortion questions in the debate. Harry Enten of CNN would have put this to Elizabeth Warren. Senator Warren, you often dismiss questions as Republican talking points, but you'll be facing a Republican in the general election. How will you respond then? And the Democratic Redistricting Committee did tweet out last night, not a single question on voting rights or gerrymandering. We have to do better. So I hit them up, and their communications director, Patrick Roddenbush, said, how about asking, how do you plan to implement changes at the federal level that will ensure America lives up to the principle of one person, one vote? I like that question. Rosa Brooks, former counselor to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, would have liked asked, is the defense budget too big, or are we just spending money on the wrong things? And also, Rosa wanted to know this. This is a Bernie Sanders specific question. Do you need a cough drop? Thanks to all the actual experts for their unasked questions. I kind of like that exercise. I'm thinking of continuing it in future debates. If you liked it, drop me a line or come to our live show on Monday and tell me in person. It's at the Bell House in Brooklyn. It's about comedy. Slate.com/live for tickets. On the show today, more debate in the spiel. Castro shivs Joe. Booker takes us back to 1850. And Kamala takes us somewhere over the rainbow. But first, the last question of last night's debate was, what's your biggest professional setback? We heard Amy Klobuchar talk about being kicked out of the hospital while her baby was sick, and Elizabeth Warren being asked to leave her job as a special needs teacher because she was pregnant, and Pete Buttigieg coming out as gay in a state where Mike Pence was the governor. All compelling professional setbacks. How about this? How about the time I was a single mom during the Great Recession, desperate to make some money? I returned to a once lucrative profession as a stripper and began drugging some Wall Street dudes and running up their credit cards. Now that's a candidate. Also, J-Lo would be the running mate. All right, I don't know if this candidacy wins Montana's 3 electoral votes, but I know it is the plot of a new movie opening today, Hustlers. You've seen the ads. You've plucked the glitter out of your belly button. Now here's my interview with Hustlers director, Loreen Scafaria.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
The Hustlers at Scores was the 2015 article by Jessica Pressler in New York Magazine that I found to be the most thrilling article I had read in years, not just because of the plot or the character, but because of the observation about the zeitgeist, where we were. A movie of that article has been made. You've probably heard about it because Jennifer Lopez establishes herself as perhaps the most charismatic human being on earth. Hustlers is the name of the film. It's directed by and written by Loreen Scafaria, who's here. Hello, Loreen. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Did you read it in 2015?
No, I wasn't that cool. I read it in...
it's a big magazine. It's on the newsstand. You don't have to be cool.
I'm not educated either. Oh, but okay. No, I wasn't aware of it. I don't know things that go viral.
But that's good. That's mostly a protective reaction.
It was sent to me in the summer of 2016 by Gloria Sanchez, who were the producers of the film.
What do you like about the article?
Everything. I loved how it was written. Yeah. I loved the story. I thought it was so compelling. I thought it was a world we hadn't really seen before from the dancer's point of view. Obviously, it was a great crime story. If you read between the lines, it's an incredible friendship story. Mm-hmm. And then it just touched on all these themes that I really wanted to talk about in my work, but touched upon them organically.
Yeah. Now, Jennifer Lopez, were you intimidated when she signed on?
No, I mean, well, I mean, I met her, you know, in order for her to sign on.
Yeah.
So I was certainly intimidated to go meet with her, but half because she's Jennifer Lopez and half because I don't know who else could have played this part. So if she didn't want to play it and if we didn't hit it off, you know,
yeah,
I don't know what I would have done. So
actual humans, like maybe Jessica Rabbit or something.
Yes.
But no, actual humans.
Yes. An animated. Yeah, absolutely. Maybe. Yeah. But so when I was going to meet with her, the stakes were obviously higher than just I'm going to meet Jennifer Lopez for the first time. And so, of course, she was everything I could have imagined she'd be.
Was it one of the cases where, I'm going to use Hollywood terms that I only hear about, but attaching the star was very important to getting it made?
Well, for me, it was, yes, let's say yes, but also, I don't know that anyone could really picture what the movie was until mm-hmm. you start to put faces to it. Because on paper, I think it's a little more threatening, honestly, and in just what it's talking about. And as soon as you start to say, well, like, look, we're approaching this as a human story, obviously, on paper, I think it's a human story, but when you start to see like, oh, yes, okay, I can imagine her bringing this to life and, oh, okay, and that's destiny and now I'm starting to get it. I think it helps people, of course, to see it.
So some of the other members of your cast, Cardi B, who has been a stripper, and Lizzo, who has blown up now, but when you cast her, were you as aware of her career as everyone is in 2019?
Well, I was chasing her for like a year before the movie was...
Cool.
Going. So I was aware, but I'm sure I was still late to the party. I feel like everybody was late to the party on that. So, but she has only blown up more and more. She's the best. She's the definition of an entertainer, too. I mean, she is just what she does to a room, what she did on set, and the life that she brought into the scenes and into the character. And she's a natural, though. She's a real actor, too. I mean, to her credit, to Cardi's credit, they're obviously just, they have incredible personalities. I don't think anybody would be surprised to know that they are great improvisers or anything like that. But they also both read lines in the script and played characters. And Cardi based Diamond on a girl she used to know. So, like, they really did step into these roles and coexist in this movie with actors and strippers and dancers and you know, megawatt stars. They were seeing them all together in that locker room.
And Lizzo does play the flute.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. You have to have her playing the flute.
I mean, I asked, but, you know, I wrote it in, but, I'm glad she said okay.
What were Jennifer's pole moves before it all started?
I believe none.
Wow.
I don't, who am I to say, but as far as I know, she had never even attempted it. And I think everyone assumes because she's a dancer that it would have just been the easiest thing to pick up, but she trained so hardcore for this. She brought this pole with her in so many different cities because she was traveling so much of the time for work. And
yeah, you can't just use whatever pole they provide, like whatever the concierge gives you.
Of course.
Especially if you're Jennifer Lopez.
Well,
you
got
to have a custom
pole.
Yeah,
well, I mean, yes, of course. And you need a great choreographer.
Yeah.
And I mean, Johanna Sapicki, who was our pole choreographer. And Jennifer had wanted this song at first, and then I presented her with Fiona Apple's Criminal because it was a similar tempo.
Right.
And I thought it said so much, and she was really into it. And so she edited into something for this dance that we only got to see, I think, 2 weeks before we shot it. And realized, oh my God, like, this is like a live event. Like, we have 300 extras watching Jennifer Lopez strip, and like, we need to cover this like the live event, like the sports event.
Yeah.
That it kind of is.
Now, did you pay the extras or did they pay you?
It's a good question. I should have said you're welcome at the end of the night and said thank you, but no, they were troopers. I mean, we had crazy hours. It was shot in 29 days, so every background person is a trooper.
But you've only done movies, right? This and The Meddler, movies you've directed in what, less than a month? That's how you always do it? Not
it's
by
brutal.
Choice.
You know, in a way, they all, like, they're too ambitious on the page and demand too many locations and span time and all that kind of stuff. So this was the amount of support that SDX gave. Honestly, like, I can't even describe it. Never experienced anything like that in my life because, I mean, people can do a lot with a little, obviously. People have made incredibly visual micro-budget movies, so that's not to say I didn't have my shots before, but this was a world I was so excited to explore in like a gritty glamour kind of way and like a little bit heightened, a little bit, grounded, all of that. It was really exciting to tackle.
How did you try? Are there visual or other techniques to make it sometimes sexy, but sometimes seedy? How do you communicate that?
That was really about, again, applying that theme of control to the camera. And so there are scenes where the characters are not in control. There are scenes where the characters are fully in control. Something like Ramona's entrance really was that moment where I felt like if she was holding the cameras and doing the dance at the same time, I would believe it. And so, yeah, it was really about capturing the world. It was also just approaching it without shame or like any ulterior motives, really. I wanted to highlight the athleticism of it. Again, like a sports movie might. Show the strength and power that these moves require. The songs, the score pieces, the Chopin cues were always written into the script to just, again, highlight that kind of grace and elegance and beauty, the ballet of it. Yeah, I wanted to capture everything. The club at its height, obviously, the there is a sexiness to it. There is a sleaziness to it sometimes. The club is a living, breathing thing, depending on who's working and who's, mm-hmm. who's come in and whether there's money flowing or not. I mean, that's the difference between a good night and a bad night, obviously.
Did you shoot it in an actual strip club?
Yes. Yeah,
which one?
It was Show Palace in Long Island City.
Oh, yeah. Is that right over the bridge?
Yeah, it's a huge strip club, so we had
to fill it. Well, it is a palace. It is palatial.
It's a palatial show. It was so funny because people told me, oh, you don't want to shoot in a real working strip club. And as soon as I saw this place, I was like, oh my gosh, this is what I've been picturing for so long. And
my dream.
I want to bring it to life. And I would say the only thing I feel bad about right now is realizing that it was closed for that week for those girls. And I just want to die. I like really do. I feel horrible. I have to go there. I have to do something to make up for it, honestly. Because, but I'm so grateful that we shot in this place because it just captured that spirit. And I just wanted that scope. You know, I always knew I wanted to follow that character from the locker room out on the floor. I wanted it to feel like football players leaving the tunnel, you know, I definitely wanted all of that roadmap out there. And so, Jane Muskey, incredible production designer, Todd Van Hazel, our DP, Mitchell Travers, I mean, our costume designer, like the three of them are just artists, you know, and every single frame is a result of that kind of collaboration. And of course, my editor who edited The Meddler, Kayla.
Do you think by doing it in 29 days, it gives it an urgency and momentum? Do you worry if your next movie, this is so successful and you get a huge budget and you have 6 months to work, you worry about pulling off that same trick in an extended amount of time?
Well, I do love the rush. I mean, I love the energy of it. I like pulling things off, but they're always that way. It doesn't even matter.
A stripper movie would be good for you.
There you go. I think you can make anything for however much time and money they give you in a way, you know, like if it's like, there's definitely a floor, obviously, for something, but I think you can make it too bloated. There's probably a ceiling too. So these are my favorite kinds of movies, the movies that aren't getting made anymore, obviously. I mean, I would very much enjoy a tentpole. I would very much enjoy making an indie again, but these are the movies I grew up on, this size of film. So honestly, I just want to do this again. I just want to get the chance to do this again.
I did mean to ask, why Chopin? I mean, there could have been different classical music cues. Mm. Always Chopin.
Always Chopin, but specifically his etudes, specifically his studies, which were, they're just the hardest things to play on piano. They're like crazy arpeggios that require flexibility and dexterity that, you know, your hands are flying around that in a way that reminded me of the dancers, reminded me of what's required for the pole work. And very specifically, those songs, very, you know, for each of those scenes that was, you know, written into the script very specifically. And it kind of wasn't until seeing, you know, Jennifer training Constance in that scene and like watching that back. And I had been editing strippers and strip teases to Chopin for like at least over a year at that point, as like a proof of concept for myself. So it was always the sound of it. Even funnier, it was always these specific recordings that I was working with. 99% of them were played by this pianist, Thomas Lyer, who comes from Germany. We couldn't locate him for so long. And I was like, but these pieces are, people don't realize how hard these are to play. Like, you can't just get even the greatest Chopin pianist in the world, someone who's won awards. Like, you cannot just say, like, here, just do Opus 25, number one. Like, just figure that out. And it's like, oh my God, it really is so, they're so hard to play. And
why'd you have to get Lyer? So he would clear it? You need his permission?
Yeah, because those are the recordings of it. I mean, even though Chopin doesn't get any money
right,
at this point.
He's in the public
domain. He's in the public domain now, but they're,
oh, really?
They're so Thomas's work. And
you can't just clear it through whoever owns the copyright.
I mean, I could have paid another pianist to have done it. And when there was one song that we did hire another pianist, Matt Herskowitz, to play. So I was very lucky to have that, because otherwise there would have been a gaping hole in the storytelling, of course.
When you say you put it together for proof of concept for yourself, do you know just when you see it, or do you get other people's reaction? How do you prove the concept to yourself?
Well, you know, it took me a long time to get the directing job. It was a writing assignment. Uh-huh. And so
they wanted Scorsese first, I understand.
Sure, yeah. I don't blame them. Me too. When they said as much, I was like, you know what? I'd be psyched to sit on one of his sets if he'd let me. So that was, I suppose, an obvious first choice. And Adam McKay is a producer on it. So I think he was another choice or a thought, you know, uh-huh. But he was making Vice. And so, no, as you can imagine, there's a large list of directors between me and Scorsese. So there were a lot of people considered for the part, for the job before I got it. And that is part of what I mean about dancing for the money. It was an earth-shattering process. But I was editing footage of it, again, not just to get myself the directing job, but to prove to them that this was a movie worth making. Because this was a hard movie to get made. I think the stigma around strippers, the stigma around, like we were talking about, female characters doing bad things, these kinds of anti-heroes, necessarily being Walter White's, it was really hard to get made. It was certainly a hard job to get. So my editor, Kayla Emter, and I cut together this sizzle reel, which was basically like a 2-minute, like almost a trailer, but using footage from other movies and music videos to act as if it's like a Hustlers trailer. And it was an amazing exercise because it showed, obviously, there's a market for this, for everything from 9 to 5 to, you know, Mean Girls, Bridesmaids. I just thought to myself, like, well, what's the difference between these movies and a story about these girls in the locker room who certainly get like a little out of control? And so it also showed me there was such a hole in the marketplace because there was just not a lot of footage of strippers in movies and from their point of view.
Right. There was this time in the 80s where every time two guys had to have a conversation,
yes,
like in Beverly Hills Cop, it would be set in a strip club for no reason other than, I guess, we had no other access to boobs on the screen.
Yes, right. Yeah. You'd see women from the waist down, right, like in the background. It was so funny because after doing this, I was watching something recently and there's a scene in a strip club, of course, and the camera's focused on the two guys at the table. And I'm going like, what am I like up against right here? I'm realizing like, oh, I'm actually not used to watching these guys actually talk and focus on them for this long.
Yeah,
it's been a while.
I'd like a whole Sopranos pass just from the Bada Bing perspective.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Just from inside.
Yes, exactly.
Laureen Scafaria is the director of Hustlers. It's out now. I would say that it's gotten quite a bit of, as they say, buzz. Yes? It's really, really an arresting movie, and you're going to be, if you see it, just blown away by Jennifer Lopez, Constance Wu, and the whole cast. Mercedes Rule, too. Thank you, Laureen.
Thank you so much.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. Maybe Julian Castro was just sick of all the people asking him, hey, wouldn't you want to be vice president? Or maybe a guy like you would be good to balance out the ticket. Or how's about a VP slot, Julian? And he just couldn't take it. What do I got to do? What do I got to do to get out of here and salvage my vice presidential chances? I know. I'm going to treat Joe Biden like he's a doddering old fool, and I'm not going to let it go. And also, and this is key to my strategy, I'm going to get the central premise wrong.
Are you
forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
Be informed.
Are you forgetting already what you said just 2 minutes ago? I mean, I can't believe that you said 2 minutes ago that they had to buy in, and now you're saying they don't have to buy. You're forgetting that.
But here's what Biden said, quote, you'll be able to get into anyone who can't afford it, gets automatically enrolled in the Medicare type option we have. Aha. See, when a candidate is tough but fair in a critique, you know, sometimes things get tough for that candidate, and that is not always fair. But when a candidate is tough but unfair, and also attacking a somewhat beloved figure to those in his party, and this is the key, the unfair part, most people will decide that that candidate sucks. At first, I thought maybe Mayor Rahm Emanuel was overstating things when he, in offering the first analysis on ABC after the debate, first guy out of the gate, what do you think happened? And Rahm Emanuel said that Castro's comments were disqualifying. But now I kind of agree with him. I think Castro really hurt himself. And I think what he's going to have to do is a no-win situation that will cement his place as an afterthought. So he's either going to have to dissemble and say he didn't mean what he said, or he'll say something like, well, I didn't really say what I said, and that'll hurt his credibility, or Castro will have to grovel and seek forgiveness, which will be hard for him to do and will probably redound in his being written off as weak. You know, if only Castro could have waited for the part with the record player. I mean, Biden started off strong, but then he got to a dithering as the night wore on. In the beginning of the debate, he was a fiery champion of incrementalism, but then he started talking about giving the kids a record player. Yeah, I know. It was supposed to be a Victrola, not a record player. We get it, you fact checkers. But in all honesty, other candidates actually said things that were just as wacky. Some seemed couched in plausibility, or even more than plausibility, solemnity. I mean, Cory Booker made an argument that I've heard before, and I will admit, I thought it was compelling. I said, wow, I didn't realize that. But then I really got to thinking about it, and I wondered what it meant. This is Cory Booker's statement.
And it's nice to go all the way back to slavery, but dear God, we have a criminal justice system that is so racially biased. We have more African Americans under criminal supervision today than all the slaves in 1850.
All right. One, that's true. That checks out. But two, when you really think about it, there's not much relevance to this statistic. It's also been true for over 20 years. There were 850,000 slaves in America in 1850. And by the mid-90s, that was when the total number of African Americans in jail, parole, or probation crossed that number. But what the statistic does is it treats incarceration as being similar to slavery, or the rationale for incarceration as being similar to slavery. Now, slavery was, of course, a pure evil that no one deserves, but obviously some of the people in prison deserve to be in prison. Every society has some people in prison. If things were going as well for the United States as was plausible, you'd still have a lot of people in prison in a country of 330 million. If the United States had the low incarceration rate of a Scandinavian country, you'd still have thousands of people and thousands of African Americans in prison. That's just reality. No one should be a slave, but you'd have to have some people in prison. And by the way, a way to ameliorate the horrors of prison are institutions like probation and parole. There is no such equivalent with slavery. I wouldn't make an analogy to certain types of slavery. I don't know what that would be in the house or in the field. I don't want to even really think about it. Slavery is unfortunate in every circumstance, and to be a prisoner is maybe unfortunate, but also maybe quite justified. It seems to work on a surface level if you say being in both situations are unmitigated horrors that no one deserves. They're different. For slavery, that's true. For prison, Sometimes it's not true. Here are some other ways to think about it. It's true. There are as many African-Americans in prison or on parole as there were slaves. But right now, there are 3 million African-Americans enrolled in college and university. And that's more than triple the number of enslaved people in 1850. To which I say, so what? What does that prove? Does that prove we're better? In 1850, there were only about 35 million Americans at all, which is less than the population of African-Americans now. There are more African-Americans today than there were Americans of any background in 1850. Again, so what? Is over-incarceration a problem? It is. Was slavery the greatest blight in our country's record? Absolutely. Are those two connected? They are, but the connection is not just illustrated by a head count. That, at least, was a statement that you had to think about. On the other hand, there was Andrew Yang's second big giveaway of the night.
My proposal is that we give every American 100 democracy dollars that you can only give to candidates and causes that you like.
Democracy dollars. Are these like Dave and Buster bucks? Are they real dollars? Are they meant to further democracy, or are they printed on a different kind of paper, maybe not even green? Are they symbolic of our commitment to our shared values? If so, isn't that what Ethereum is? Andrew Yang is definitely the only person on that stage who could explain the blockchain. Is that what was going on? Maybe you start small. Maybe get Bernie to promise socialism cents. Then you segue into democracy dollars. This was, by the way, Andrew Yang's second big cash giveaway of the night. He did promise 10 lucky viewers $1,000 a month for a year. So the 100 democracy dollars, it's more of a box on the display floor than what was behind curtain number two. And maybe he'll throw in a ceramic Dalmatian and a gift certificate. So if Booker said something that seemed to hold great import but really didn't, and if Yang said something that on its face was risible, Kamala Harris got all relatable.
Donald Trump in office on trade policy, you know, he reminds me of that guy in The Wizard of Oz. You know, when you pull back the curtain, it's a really small dude.
Oh, you mean The Wizard of Oz? That guy in The Wizard of Oz who's behind the curtain, he's The Wizard of Oz. He reminds me of, in Being John Malkovich, that bald character actor who's a little weird. You know the guy I mean? You know what he reminds me of? Those four guys who chase and capture ghosts from that movie Ghostbusters, you know what it's like? It's like in the Owls of Gahul, Legends of the Guardian, one of those owls who are from, where were they from? I believe it was Gahul. And then George Stephanopoulos got a little offended and Kamala Harris said this.
But I am going to take this to Sanders.
George, it wasn't about you.
I'm
going to
take this to Sanders.
No, it wasn't. It was about The Wizard of Oz. That is who it was about. The guy in The Wizard of Oz who she was referring to was The Wizard of Oz. So like I said in the top of the show, no clear winner, but to be clear, some very weird stuff. It's like the lesson I took from that movie, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, about the state of the world. Just that, you know, it's kind of crazy. And that's it for today's show. The Gist was produced by Daniel Schrader, who reminds me of that guy in The English Patient. He was from Britain. I believe he was like in the hospital or something. Help me out here. The Gist. We're like that podcast that really gets to the nub or heart of the matter. No. You're thinking about the one that came out today and explained things. That's Today Explained. This is more like, I don't know. Anyway, I hope to see you Monday night in that house where they have the bells in Brooklyn. You know the one I mean. Oompa-roo-de-pa-roo-doo-pa-roo. And thanks for listening.